If you will turn back to Galatians chapter 2, we'll look at the last few verses of chapter 2 that we didn't get to look at this morning. The bulk of this morning's, well, all of this morning's sermon dealt with hypocrisy, but there were a few things there at the end that I didn't get to deal with that I want to deal with real quick before we get into chapter 3. And that's why we skipped that one song, so that there would be plenty of time to cover all of this here tonight. But in Galatians chapter 2, find verse 16, please. Knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ, even we have believed in Jesus Christ, that we might be justified by the faith of Christ, and not by the works of the law, for by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. But if, while we seek to be justified by Christ, we ourselves also are found sinners, is therefore Christ the minister of sin? God forbid. For if I build again the things which I destroyed, I make myself a transgressor. For I, through the law, am dead to the law, that I might live unto God. I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. I do not frustrate the grace of God, for if righteousness come by the law, then Christ is dead in vain. Just a couple of things here as we look at these last few verses before we move on to chapter 3. And verse 16 here in chapter 2 deals with one of the themes here of this book, that salvation is by faith and not works. And at the end of verse 16, it says, for by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. So in doing the works of the law, even if one were to keep the law, you can't be saved by the law. The reason that no flesh will be justified by doing the works of the law is because the law can't save us. Now, if someone were to keep every point of the law, okay? If you or I were capable from birth on up, if we were capable to keep every point of the law, the reason that it cannot save us, the reason keeping the law cannot save us, is because in keeping it, there's one little matter that hasn't been dealt with, and that is the sin nature that we have. We're born fallen, okay? So when we come into this world, we're already separated from Christ. We're already sinners by birth. Remember, sinners by birth and sinners by choice. So if my choice was different and I didn't sin by choice, if I fulfilled the law and kept every single ordinance of the law, and what we forget sometimes is that the law is not just the Ten Commandments. That's the moral law. The law itself is, I think it's over 600 different, I don't even know how many, but I think there are at least 600 different points in the law, things that they had to do, ceremonial law and all that. There's just, you know, hundreds and hundreds of them. But even if I could keep those, which the fact that I'm born a fallen man keeps me from keeping those, but even if I could keep those, and even if I was able to do that, I still couldn't stand before God and say, hey, I fulfilled your law, I did everything that you said, I still wouldn't be justified because I still came in broken. I came in a sinner. And so that's why the law can't save us. It has no power to save us. It can't do anything. It cannot do anything. It cannot have any effect on the fact that man is born separated from God and that we're born sinners. So salvation is by faith and not works. And then in verses 17 and 18, he points out that going back to the law is sin. Going back to the law is sin. Notice he says, for if I build again the things which I destroyed, I make myself a transgressor. So going back to those things that that I'm no longer under, if I put myself back underneath the law, I'm sinning by doing that. Because we have the grace of God now, and we've always had the grace of God, but we're in this church age, this age of grace. Once you get saved, okay, before you get saved, the law points out that you need to be saved, and then when you get saved, we now have this grace of God, and salvation has always been. We put our faith in Jesus Christ, and we're saved by grace. And the Bible tells us that, as a matter of fact, in the coming chapter, and we're not going to look at it tonight, but in the coming chapter, we read about Abraham, and he wasn't justified by his works. He was justified by faith, and it was imputed unto him for righteousness. But going back to that law that couldn't do anything for me except show me that I needed to be saved, if I go back to that, then I'm building again look, he says, for if I build again the things which I destroyed, if I go back and I get back into the law and it couldn't save me, then I've sinned. And that's what the Galatians were doing. They were sinning they weren't lost, they hadn't lost their salvation, but they were erring because they were going back to the law voluntarily that could not save them, and they were under grace. And so going back to the law is a sin. And what he's saying here also in verses 17 and 18 is this: I'm not living in grace as I should if I do that. Okay, I'm going back to the law. That's a sin, and I'm not living in grace the way that I should. And if you look down at verse 21. I do not frustrate the grace of God, for if righteousness come by the law, then Christ is dead in vain. And so, very simple, law and grace cannot be combined. Frustrating the grace of God is what the Galatians were doing by trying to mix law and grace together. That's the definition. So what does he mean when he says, I do not frustrate the grace of God? That's what they were doing. Trying to mix grace and law, trying to add works to salvation, trying to say, well, yeah, I'm saved, but I still have to do these things, you know, for God to be pleased with me and for me to stay saved, or however you want to word it or look at it. If we add anything to the grace of God, we are frustrating that grace. You know, we take that word frustrate. Why do we get frustrated sometimes? We normally get frustrated when something isn't working the way that it should. Something isn't going the way that it should. I get frustrated. I don't work on, about the only work I do on my vehicles is, I can't do anything major. You know, I can do all the general maintenance and everything, and I've made some repairs where I didn't know what I was doing, but I got online and read about it and watched some videos and learned how to do it, and so you know, there are some things that I can do whenever I'm working on the car. But one thing that aggravates me is this: most vehicles made pre-1980s, or even some in the 80s, a lot of those vehicles, you could just about sit down inside of the engine and work on them. You just had plenty of room. I've thought about buying an old truck just to be able to work on it if I ever need to do anything, having the room to do it. Because you could literally, some of these pickup trucks, you could literally sit up on the edge and reach and let your legs hang over and get down there and work. There was room to work. Well, I go to work on that Sebring that we have, or that Town and Country, and there are made after the year 2000, and you open it up, and man, you can't even slide a piece of paper between most of the parts in there. And then you get up underneath it, and you can't see anything, and I get frustrated when I work on stuff like that. And I get frustrated because normally, and I'm sure it's this way with most of you, normally my vehicles need worked on in the wintertime. and I've never owned a garage. And so I'm out working in the cold. When we lived in Spencer, we had gravel, cold, gravel. Everything hurts more when it's cold. And you don't know you're bleeding until you get back in the house because, you know, you cut yourself and then it freezes and then you go in and thaw out and then you're bleeding all over everything. But you smash everything and you can't reach it in between stuff and tools are falling on your face because you're trying to work up here and everything. That frustrates me. It's frustrating. You know why? Because it's not going the way that it should. It's not working like it should. That's frustrating. I'll tell you another one. If you ever have to work on the wiring that's underneath your dashboard, that's frustrating. You got to lay this, the way I have done it, you got to lay the seat down and lay in the seat upside down with your feet sticking up and your head's under there and you're trying to work like this and you can't get to anything. It's just frustrating. That little tiny stuff that you can't get it to work. We get frustrated when things don't work the way that they should. Well, law has no place in the gospel of grace. And so when we try to add elements of the law, even one element of the law, to the gospel of grace, we are frustrating grace. You know why? Because grace doesn't work that way. We're trying to make the grace of God, we're trying to make salvation work in a way that it's not designed to work, that it doesn't work like that, okay? It doesn't work. I'm out there working on the car, and I come in, and you know, Amy says, what's going on? It's not working. I can't get that thing off of there, and it's just not doing. It doesn't look the way it looked in the picture, and it's just not working. You get frustrated, okay? Salvation is all about grace. And when we try to take an element of the law and add it to that, you know what happens? It doesn't work. It's not working. We could say, no, this isn't working. Why isn't it working? Because I keep trying to fulfill this law and I can't do it. And I just can't do it. I can't do it. And it's frustrating. Leave the grace of God alone. It's so hard for man to do because we just feel like we have to put our hands on everything. We just feel like we have to have a hand in everything. We find it so hard. By nature, man finds it so hard just to leave things alone. I know men in particular, we're like that. I mean, I'll say it before you ladies say it. We just always have to be messing with something. We do. We always have to be messing with something. We've got to always be taking something apart and fiddling with and everything. It's just that's how we're made and that's what we enjoy doing. Is you know we gotta mess with. Oh, I can fix that. I can make that better. I could build. You know, I could make that taller. You know what? I could probably soup that thing up. And we just always got to be doing something. And some of that's okay, but not when it comes to the grace of God. Hands off. Do not touch. Keep off the grass. No trespassing. Leave the grace of God alone. Let it do what it's supposed to do and quit trying to help God out. If God needed help, He ain't asking any of us. We've already proven we can't help. The grace of God, it's sufficient. It's enough. It's enough for everything that I'm going to encounter. It's everything that I need. And I don't need to help out by trying to do the things of the law. It doesn't work. It frustrates things. So leave it alone. So law and grace cannot be combined. Now we move into chapter 3, okay? Chapter 1, he deals with his apostleship. In chapter 2, he deals with his authority. And now, he just got done talking specifically about this thing of law and grace and not mixing law and grace. And so now, chapter 3 on, really starts to get down to this is the real heart of the epistle. Real heart of the epistle. And what Paul is going to deal with here in chapter 3 is the bondage of the law. Okay, the bondage of the law and how it can't save and all of that, the bondage of the law. And this is somewhat of a, what we're going to look at this morning or this evening. He's going to ask some questions, okay? We're going to look at some questions that the Apostle Paul is asking. And basically what it is, it's a call to remember. It's a call to remember. That title reminds me of Brother Tracy Killinger because his ministry is a call to the world ministries. And whenever you look on his website and read some of his articles, that's kind of his ism. That's kind of his thing, is that he'll write something and it'll be, a call to prayer. Since it's a call to the world ministries, he'll write something or preach something and say, a call to prayer or a call to worship, a call to praise. And so I believe Brother Tracy would be very happy to hear that we're preaching tonight on a call to remember. In dealing with this thing, this subject of the bondage of the law, what he's doing in these first five verses, the Apostle Paul now, is he gets right down to the heart of this epistle. He's getting right down to it, and he's calling them to remember a few things. And in verses 1 through 5, that's what he's going to do. In the third chapter, like I said, now that he's already proven his apostleship and his authority, he moves on to the real, we could say, meat of what needs to be dealt with here. And it's time for him to explain and then apply the gospel of grace. Okay, he's going to explain the gospel of grace in the chapters to come. He's going to explain the gospel of grace and he's going to apply and help them to apply the gospel of grace. Let's read verses 1 through 5. O foolish Galatians, who hath bewitched you, that you should not obey the truth, before whose eyes Jesus Christ hath been evidently set forth, crucified among you? This only would I learn of you, received ye the Spirit by the works of the law, or by the hearing of faith? Are you so foolish, having begun in the Spirit, are you now made perfect in the flesh? Have ye suffered so many things in vain, if it be yet in vain? He therefore that ministereth to you the Spirit and worketh miracles among you, doeth he it by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith? It is a very effective, there are different teaching tools, okay? Different tools that you can use whenever you teach to help people remember, help people understand what you're trying to teach. One of those is a lot of pastors' favorite one is alliteration, where every point begins with the same letter or the same two or three letters. And I have heard and I have read some pastors who do that so much that it's counterproductive. I get lost in it. Because they try so hard to alliterate everything, you start to get confused, with what they're trying to say and what they're trying to do. But alliteration is one way to help. They say that it kind of helps people, recall and remember. Another thing is to ask questions. When the teacher, when the instructor asks the student questions. You know why that's helpful? Because it gets their brain working. It makes people stop and think. It makes people run it over in their head. And sometimes instead of just receiving instruction, when you're called upon to stop and think about it and remember, it's a little more effective. And so Paul here, he takes the first, and I'm not saying that's why he did this, but I'm just saying it is helpful sometimes when you're trying to get a point across to ask people questions. Because you know what? Someone could stand there and say something to you over and over and over again, and you can argue with it and disagree with it, but if it comes from your lips, it's awful hard for you to disagree with what you just said. That's why sometimes we ask questions and we break things down and get people to answer us back, and then they give the right answers, and then we say, okay, now you just said, okay, by your own admission, you just said this. Well, what are you going to do? Stand there and argue with yourself? Well, don't listen to me. I'm a liar. Okay? Well, it's very helpful. It's very helpful to ask questions because then you call. It's an easier way to recall it to someone's mind. And it's effective because whenever it comes from their own lips and they answer the question, they're less likely to argue with it. So in these first five verses, he asks a series of questions. And that's what I want to look at tonight. That's the call to remember. He's calling them to remember certain things. He's basically saying, now listen, I want you to stop and I want you to think about a few things. I want you to stop and think and remember. Do you know that we as people, we as nations, churches, whatever you want to look at, you know, one of the things that gets us in a lot of trouble is that we forget, is that we don't stop and remember, okay? What is the old saying? Those who don't remember history are destined to repeat it. Isn't that how it goes? Something along those lines. Okay? That's why it's very detrimental for us to remember bad decisions that our nation has made and other nations have made. It's very important for us to remember what was done and what the outcome was so that we can try not to make that mistake next time. We get in trouble when we stop remembering those things that we need to remember. And so that's kind of his approach here. He wants to, it seems as though he's just trying to get them to think and answer some of these questions. Okay, so in these first five verses, if I could sum those up, the message of these first five verses is the law can't do it because it never could. And he begins to really break that down. He's already made some of these comments, but now he's going to really get down to business here and break this down. The law can't do it because it never could. Excuse me. Verse 1, O foolish Galatians, ow. Talk to your friends like that? Well, open rebuke is better than secret love, the Bible tells us. And the kisses of an enemy are deceitful, the Bible tells us. But faithful are what? The wounds of a friend. Sometimes we have to be blunt with the people that we love, and sometimes God has to be blunt with us just to wake us up. It's not meanness. It's not meanness. We just need to be woken up sometimes. And he says, oh, foolish Galatians, who hath bewitched you that ye should not obey the truth before whose eyes Jesus Christ hath been evidently set forth, crucified among you? Oh, foolish Galatians, who hath bewitched you? Let's look at this word. They were bewitched. They were This defines the state that they were in. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean to be bewitched? Well, I'm going to read to you two definitions that fit here. The first one is to fascinate, to charm, to please to such a degree as to take away the power of resistance. Okay? So that's kind of what the both of these definitions really deal with what a magician might do or what sorcerers did. Okay, they would trick people, they would fool people. You know, we understand that there's no such thing as real magic. If you watch a magic show or something like that, we understand that it's all tricks. It's all tricks. It can look very convincing, but it's all a trick. Okay? So another definition is this: to deceive or mislead by juggling tricks or imposter. Okay? So basically, to bewitch someone means to charm or fascinate them, to charm them or to fascinate them so that you can mislead them. And then it says, as to take away the power of resistance. So they would get to such a point where they would no longer resist. They would no longer resist what the person was trying to do or how the person was trying to fool them. It's trickery. To bewitch someone is
trickery. And so basically he's saying to them, I mean, we get our word witchcraft has to do with this. It's trickery. It's you know, sorcery and witchcraft and everything is to get some kind of a hold on someone by using tricks and then be able to get them to do what you want them to do. And so basically he's saying, hey, you've been duped. Who duped you? Who tricked you? Who entranced you? Who swayed your thinking in such a way? Oh, foolish Galatians, who hath bewitched you? Who are you listening to? That's the first question. The first question is, who are you listening to? Someone has come along and they have tricked you. They have charmed you. They have fascinated you. Who is it? And this is a separate application, but from time to time, we as Christians have to stop. Whenever we get off track in our thinking, we have to stop and we have to ask ourselves, who am I listening to? How did I get here? Something's wrong and I'm off track. And who bewitched me? Who tricked me? Who was crafty and cunning and I listened to them along the way and got off track? But he says, who hath bewitched you? Let's look at Acts chapter 8, first of all. Look at Acts chapter 8 as we look at this word and this state that they're in of being bewitched. Acts chapter 8. And verse 9. But there was a certain man called Simon, which before time in the same city used sorcery and bewitched the people of Samaria, giving out that himself was some great one. And then look at verse 10, to whom they all gave heed, from the least to the greatest, saying, this man is the great power of God. So there was a man named Simon, the sorcerer. He was tricking people. He was bewitching people. Why? For his own personal gain. He was influencing them. He was trying to get something from them, to get them to follow him and think that he was a man of God. And he had tricked them. Said that he had used sorcery, so he had used tricks and things to maybe it was false signs and miracles that we read about, but whatever he had done, he did something to trick them and get them to think that he was a man of God. That's going to happen during the tribulation. That's going to happen during the tribulation. Those false signs and miracles and wonders that are going to take place will be to try to deceive people, to fool people. That's what illusions and magic shows are all about. They're trying to trick you. Except when we go in and we sit down and watch a magic show, we know we're about to be tricked. And we know, well, it's just a trick. Let's see how they do it. So here's a man who was trying to trick people. Okay, now go to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Therefore, verses 1 and 2, therefore, seeing we have this ministry as we have received mercy, we faint not, but have renounced the hidden things of dishonesty, not walking in craftiness, nor handling the word of God deceitfully, but by manifestation of the truth, commending ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God. So do you mean to tell me there are people who pose as pastors and preachers and evangelists and missionaries who act, who are deceitful and trick people to try to get something out of them? The world's full of them. And they've always been around. We just read about one back in the book of Acts. Simon the sorcerer was trying to get people to think he was doing the works of God. trying to trick people. I can't speak on this without sharing a story with you. I was telling Amy about this. I think it was last night. But a friend of mine, he's got a bit of an ornery streak. A few years ago, he called one of those TV preachers, one of those prosperity gospel guys, and was asking about how to be saved and everything. He's already saved. And he was asking them how to be saved and everything, and because he wanted to see what they would say to him, and they couldn't tell him anything. They could take his check, but that's all they could do. They could, if he wanted to sow his seed, they could take that, but they couldn't tell him anything about how to be saved. And so he did it again the other day. There was this guy on TV. His name was, he calls himself Prophet something. And so my friend calls him, and he got an answering machine, okay? And really what he's doing is he's I'm telling you, he's ornery. He's kind of playing a trick on his wife. He calls and he gets this answering machine, and he says, yeah, I just saw you on TV and was wanting to know about salvation, how to be saved and everything. And it said to leave your name and address. Well, he left his address, but he left somebody else's name, this guy that he and his wife knew years ago, because he wanted to see his wife's reaction when they got a letter in the mail addressed to this guy that they knew years ago. But anyhow, all that aside, he sends me a copy of the letter. And there's nothing in it about salvation. There's nothing. It's handwritten. And from the very beginning, God has shown me this is the year of released blessing, and I need a picture of you that I can pray over to make sure that you get the blessing. And if you send $46.12, then we'll, you know, send you this and everything. And on the back of the letter, it says, God has instructed me to get our special vial of anointing oil into your hands. Use this to anoint your checkbook and your wallet and everything. And I wrote back to my, he sent me an email on this, and I wrote back to my friend. I said, it's funny, God instructed him to get that oil into your hand, but God didn't bother telling him that that's not your real name. You gave him a fake name, and God doesn't point that out to him, but God does tell him to get the oil into your hand. Now, we look at that and we say, oh, that's silly, that's crazy. You know why those guys remain on TV? Because people listen. It's working. This one person in particular whose show this guy was on has been on there for years. If I said his name, you might know him, or you might recognize him if I described his looks. People listen. You know why? They're bewitched. They're entranced. They're pulled in. They're hooked. They're caught up in it. And that's what the Galatians were doing. They were listening to something they shouldn't have been listening to because they were hooked. And Paul says to them, who hath bewitched you? Who is it that has tricked you? Who is it that has done this? If you go to 2 Peter with me, 2 Peter chapter 2. Second Peter chapter 2. And verses 1 through 3. But there were false prophets also among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you, who privily shall bring in damnable heresies, even denying the Lord that bought them, and bring upon themselves swift destruction. And many shall follow their pernicious ways, by reason of whom the way of truth shall be evil spoken of. And through covetousness shall they with feigned words make merchandise of you, whose judgment now of a long time lingereth not, and their damnation slumbereth not. So Peter says there's going to be a time when people start to come in and bring in all of these heresies and these teachings because they're trying to make money off of you. They're trying to get something from you. They're tricking you because they want something out of you. Well, back in Galatians, go back to Galatians chapter 3, the very word bewitched, proves what their motives were. These men These are not some of the ones that we read about in Acts a week or two ago. Some of the Pharisees who had believed and still thought that you had to obey the law. Those were men who were honestly trying to figure this thing out and honestly thought that that made sense. That's not who these people are. These Judaizers are people who are purposely tricking and bewitching people. Okay, that word bewitched shows us what their motive is. The word bewitched proves the motive of these Judaizers. They're either there just to stir up trouble, or they're there to try to get something from these people, put these people in bondage, get these people to listen to them, whatever it may be. And so he goes on and he says, in verse number 2, "This only would I learn of you, received ye the Spirit by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith?" So his question here, his first question is, who bewitched you? Who tricked you? Now he kind of goes a little bit further. Okay, he's in a couple of verses, he's going to come back to that "who tricked you" question. He's going to come back to "who hath bewitched you? Who was it that tricked you?" He's going to come back to that. But right here, he says, "This only would I learn of you, received ye the Spirit by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith?" If works can't save, then they can't keep. And his question is, how did you get saved? Did you get saved by obeying the law? Or did you get saved by faith in Jesus Christ? What brought salvation? Okay? What brought salvation to you? He says, "Received you the Spirit by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith?" Okay, somebody has bewitched you, somebody has tricked you. Now let me ask you this: how'd you get saved? Did you get saved by obeying the law? Did you get saved by faith in Jesus Christ? Well, obviously, they've been saved by faith in Jesus Christ, not the works of the law. So why would we continue in something that wasn't able to save us in the first place? Okay, calling the Galatians to remember. Now, how did I get saved? I didn't get saved by obeying the law. I got saved by faith in Jesus Christ. Why would I continue in something that couldn't save me? So his first question is, who hath bewitched you? And his second question is, how'd you get saved? Then he goes on to verse 3, "Are ye so foolish, having begun in the Spirit, are ye now made perfect by the flesh?" So his third question here is, Galatians, wasn't the Spirit of God enough? Wasn't the grace of God sufficient? Wasn't it enough? What was it? "Are you so foolish, having begun in the Spirit, are you now made perfect by the flesh?" If you got saved by grace, were you not saved enough? Was there something lacking that you had to do the works of the flesh to make it complete? Look, "received you the Spirit by the works of the law?" Verse 3. "Having begun in the Spirit, are you now made perfect by the flesh?" If you got saved by grace, then let grace do the work. If it wasn't works that saved you, then works doesn't need to complete anything. If grace saved you, it's complete, it's sufficient. That's all you need. Okay? So, who are you listening to, Galatians? Who's tricked you here? And then, how'd you get saved? Law or grace? How'd you get saved? And then number 3, when you got saved, wasn't the Spirit enough? Verse 3, wasn't the Spirit enough? Is the grace of God not sufficient? Did the law that couldn't save somehow acquire the power to save? Couldn't save you before, did it all of a sudden receive the power to save you? If you needed the Spirit of God because the law was not sufficient, why would you need the law now? Either the Spirit is enough
or it's not enough. Either the Spirit is enough or it's not enough. And that's what he's saying to them. And that's what he's calling to mind. He has another question for them in verse 4. Have you suffered so many things in vain, if it be yet in vain? So his fourth question, what'd you suffer for? What did you suffer for? Did you suffer because of the law, or did you suffer because you put your faith and trust in Jesus Christ for salvation? And if you suffered, you suffered for the gospel. Is that all in vain now? Does that mean nothing now? Are you turning your back on that now? You ever worked real hard for something and then something happened to it? You know, a man builds a home and puts a lot of time and energy and money and work into it, and then it's lost in a fire? That's devastating, isn't it? Man, all that work and everything, and now it's gone. Or you work and work and work for something, and it was for nothing. You got nowhere. Well, what he's asking them is, did you suffer in vain? You suffered for the gospel. You suffered because you put your faith and trust in Jesus Christ. Was that for nothing? Was that all in vain? So why did you suffer? They'd suffered for the truth of the gospel because they believed the doctrine of grace. If they returned to the law, then they suffered in vain. They suffered for the gospel of grace, the gospel of Jesus Christ. And if they returned to the law, then they suffered for nothing. They absolutely suffered for nothing. But then he says here, if it be yet in vain. And I think what this means is that he's not sure. He's writing this epistle to them. He's not sure how far they have gone into this doctrine of law plus grace. So I think what he's saying here is he's saying, if that's what's happened, if you have completely turned your back on grace, then you suffered for grace in vain. But I think when it says, if it be, he's not sure, because he's writing a letter, he's not there with them, he's not sure just how far they've gone in listening to the Judaizers. But if they had embraced this doctrine of theirs that you had to add law to grace, then he's telling them, hey, you suffered in vain. None of us like to suffer and then find out it was for nothing. I mean, can you imagine what a waste it would be to sit in a dentist chair for 5 hours and you just happen to go on the day that they ran out of Novocaine the night before, but you got to get it out. And so, you know, they're digging and scratching and grinding, and you're in there for 5 hours. And you guys should all see yourselves from my point of view. You're all going, oh! First we had to listen to Clayson, now we have to listen to this. Can you imagine getting up and walking out of that, you know, walking out of there, and then they say, well, we didn't get it out. What? What'd you do in there? Oh, it was a mess. We didn't do any good. You're going to have to come back tomorrow. I did all that suffering. I suffered, and you guys didn't even fix it. You suffered in vain is what you did. And that's what he's saying to them. He said, you know, if you go back to this idea of law, if you go back and you add law to grace, then he's saying all the suffering you've done has been for nothing. Nobody wants to suffer in vain. But that's exactly what they were doing if they went back to it. And then in verse 5, he asks another question. He therefore that ministereth to you the Spirit and worketh miracles among you, doeth he it by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith? So his question here is, don't you remember how it all started when you got saved? Don't you remember where the power came from? When Paul's calling to their mind, what he's saying, when I was there and I preached among you and you got saved and you saw the wonders and you saw the miracles and things that were wrought, when you saw all of that, how did that come about? Was that because of the law or was it through the Spirit? So he's saying, remember when you got saved. Remember when I was there preaching and you saw the evidence that what I was preaching through the miracles and the signs, you saw the evidence that what I was speaking was the truth of God. Did I preach that to you? Was all of that done through the Spirit or by the works of the law? Okay? So he's saying, think back. Think back to when you embraced the gospel of Jesus Christ, when you got saved, and you saw the miracles working and you saw the evidence. Was it the law that brought about those miracles and those manifestations, or was it the Spirit? He says, He therefore that ministereth to you the Spirit and worketh miracles among you, doeth he it by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith? Okay, think about what you saw. Think about when you got saved. Was it the law that did all that? Were you saved by the law back then, or was it the Spirit? Was it because of faith in Jesus Christ? When I preached to you in power, and you witnessed the signs and the wonders and the miracles. Basically what Paul's saying is, when all that happened, what was I preaching? Was I preaching law to you, or was I preaching grace to you? So by asking these five questions, it brings the Galatians to a point where they have to answer and they have to deal with these answers. And we know the answer to all of these questions. We know that the ones who had bewitched them were not sent of God because they weren't preaching the gospel, the true gospel of grace. We know how they got saved. We know how we got saved. Faith in Jesus Christ. It had nothing to do with the works of the law. We know, question number three, verse number three, that the Spirit was enough. And we don't need the law to finish the work. We know that they didn't suffer in vain, and we haven't suffered in vain if we will hold to the gospel of grace. But if we go back to the law, then what'd we suffer for then? What good was it? And we know. See, there, verse 5 is not a direct application to us because we didn't see the Apostle Paul working miracles, but we know biblically how that happened through the power of the Holy Spirit. Faith, the doctrine, the gospel of grace, we know that we were saved by grace. Why go back to the law? So if the law couldn't do it then, you know what? It still can't. It can't do it now. If it couldn't then, it didn't gain any strength. It can't do it now. You were not saved by the law. You never could be. If it can't save, then it can't keep. If the law can't save you, then doing certain works while you're saved can't keep you saved. It's either all Jesus or nothing. Why be so foolish as to add anything to the grace of God? Man does that. We do things like that. We shouldn't do that. You know, have you ever seen, something that looks beautiful to you or looks just perfect, looks just right, and then somebody does something to mess it up, and you say to him, you say, wow, you just ruined it. Leave it alone. It's good the way it is. You know, it's good the way it is. Ice cream is good the way it is. Don't ruin it by pouring root beer on it. Leave it alone. Now, some of you think that makes it better. I say, leave it alone. Don't pour that root beer on there. And don't ruin the root beer by putting ice cream in it, because it's good by itself. But we look at something and we say, no, that's good right there, right there, right there. That's perfect. Leave it alone. That's the grace of God. It's perfect. It's all we need. It's sufficient. Leave it alone. Quit trying to add to it. Quit trying to take away from it. Leave it alone. The law couldn't save. It can't now. It couldn't keep. It can't now. It's either law or grace, and the Bible makes it clear, it's grace. It's all about the grace of Jesus Christ. Okay, next week, Paul will begin to expound. He starts to give some examples. He talks about Abraham next week, and we'll look at that. We'll look at that Sunday morning. I believe tonight we won't have our closing hymn tonight. We'll just dismiss with a word of prayer.